One of the things that happens is when I came to AA, I came in at 31 years old. The truth of the matter is I knew everything. But that's all I knew. I didn't know anything else. And what you don't know, if you're an alcoholic and you come to AA, what you don't know is you don't know anything. You don't know you don't know anything. If you're lucky, you have a pretty good idea you don't know anything. And one of the things you don't know is you don't know what the hell is wrong with you. And the truth of the matter is, you may not know what the hell is wrong with you for many years after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You may get glimpses and things like that. You can't really tell what's wrong with you when you're in the midst of drinking, because you can't even experience alcoholism when you're drinking. You experience you know what I mean? My sponsor said, why do you do the things you do? Why do you say the things you say? And I said, well, that's just my personality. And he said, well, it's your personality that's killing you. I don't know how to stop drinking. I don't know how to stop my personality. I don't know how to stop me. And you can't really experience alcoholism when you're always drinking. Because I drank, it was a symptom of the disease. It wasn't the disease. I drank because I had the disease. And I don't know what the disease is. I don't understand the disease. All I know is that every once in a while I say, I need a drink. As a matter of fact, it's not every once in a while, it's all the time. It's every time I'm talking to a woman, it's every time I have to dance, it's every time I have to go to a party, it's every time, all I know is there's something inside me that says, I need a drink. I can't do this thing without a drink. And for many years it worked. I'm an alcoholic because no woman, no suit of clothes, no amount of money ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. And it worked for me every time. And it worked like that, you know what I mean? Bam. Alcoholics, men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's the way it worked for me. And, you know, if it worked for me today, the way it worked for me when I was 18 years old, I'd still be drinking. I'd be drunk down there somewhere. But unfortunately or fortunately, the deal is with my story is it doesn't work for me anymore, so I don't drink it. But the bottom line is when I stopped drinking it, when I came to AA and I spoke a little bit about this today when I talked about emotional sobriety, and I'm going to talk a little bit about emotional sobriety in my life because it's part of my story tonight. And I'll just tell you, my deal is I love newcomers. I know there's probably newcomers here, but I have a real heart for people who have been around for a while that are living lives of quiet desperation because, you know, I sponsor guys that have 25 years, who have 20 years, who have 15 years, who are dying inside. They're not being rocketed into the fourth. You know, the big book says we're rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. We're experiencing much of heaven. You know, it talks about something. And there are people, I want you to know, there are people who are up 10, 15 years, 20 years, and they're living lives of quiet desperation. They're not drinking one day at a time, but they're just not happy. There's a part in the big book that it says, well, I'll read it. You know, one of the things that happens when you're in AA for a while and you start experiencing, my sponsor used to say, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will walk away with an experience. There's just something about going through the crap that teaches you a lesson. That's from the book of James, as a matter of fact. You know, the AA started in 35 and the big book was written in 39. It said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And their path, what they said in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, is it said, the books we found absolutely essential were 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James. And, you know, you can have opinions about that. And by the way, I'm going to mention a lot of stuff that you, trust me, I'm going to mention some stuff here that you probably haven't heard or will not hear in any other AA meetings. And I just do it because it's my authentic side. It has to do with my story. It's not meant to piss anybody off, but if you want to be pissed off, be my guest. You're an alcoholic. I'm entitled to do that. Just remember one thing. If I say anything to piss you off, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So, I mean, you understand? And you know, there may be something wrong with me, but there's something wrong with you. So I know how this thing works. If I'm not pissing off at least 25% of the people, I probably haven't said shit. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying anything. And there's always this sort of like, if you're an alcoholic, one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is you want people to love you. You want to belong. You want people to think highly of you. So there's always, even now at almost 37 years, there's always this sort of like, sort of game my mind is playing on me. Should I say this? You know, I mean, I, you know, should I tell him the truth or should I sort of back off a little bit? Should I tell him the truth or should I sort of water it down a little bit? You know, not really tell him the whole deal or change some names, you know, to protect the guilty. And the truth of the matter is that I've always, I think, I hope I've always come down on taking the risk and telling the truth and letting it just all hang out there. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm just going to tell you the truth about my life. This is my life, not your life. You don't have to do it. You don't have to agree. But I know how this thing works, because I've gone to many meetings. When you're a sick and suffering alcoholic and you're emotionally and spiritually diseased and you walk into a place like this, you're liable every once in a while to run into somebody like a sponsor or somebody who's talking, who says things that piss you off. Did you know that? I mean, that's possible. As a matter of fact, when you find that you're listening to somebody and they're pissing you off, you know, ask that guy to be your sponsor. Because the guys that like you and think you're cute and are co-signing your bullshit, they're not going to help you. You understand what I'm saying? You better go with the guy who's saying stuff that you don't like, because he's probably the guy that'll keep you sober for 30 years. But so I've gone to many meetings and I've had interactions I've had three sponsors, because we're all temporary. You know, he says, I'll be your temporary sponsor. Well, hell, these guys will die on me, you know, and I love them all. But when you're sponsored by people and you go to meetings, very often you'll come out of meetings and you'll be pissed off. You'll say, who the hell does that guy think he is? Why would he say that? He doesn't know me. And what I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're working this program, and you got that spiritual axiom going, whenever you're disturbing, no matter what the cause is, something wrong with you, is that you can be pissed off for a while, but after a while, you start thinking to yourself, instead of pointing fingers and being mad, because you know resentment is number one offender, is you start thinking, why am I so pissed off? Why is this guy pissing me off? And maybe you'll do an inventory. Russell, he says I have to believe in God. You know, he says this, he says that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you start going through the whole process of the inventory. You speak to your sponsor, you pray. And then somewhere along the line, you all of a sudden a thought comes through, and the thought is this: holy shit, he's right. And I've been around long enough, so I can't tell you how many guys have come up to me and say, you know, you're Russell. I said, yeah. He says, you know, I used to hate you, but now I love you. I can't tell you how many people have told me that when they first heard me, I hated your guts, you know, but now they've, after 2 or 3 or 4 or 20 years, whatever it is, and they've experienced life on life's turn, and they've been through the stuff, all of a sudden now they sort of like understand what I'm talking about. So I'm just going to talk about some things. And in any event, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if I can find this part, Envision for You. Sometimes what happens is after you go through life's challenges and stuff like that, you know, I've had this happen to me all along. I've had it happen to me in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, in 25 years. You'll be reading something in the book that you've probably read 1,000 times, means absolutely nothing to you. And then all of a sudden, one night at 3 o'clock in the morning, when something's bothering you and you can't get it out of your head and you can't go to sleep, and you've tried to think about the same thing over and over and over again, you know, how are you going to get more money in the bank? You know, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to get this? What's going to happen? And it's just driving you crazy. And when all else fails, you can't sleep, you open up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you read a line that you read 10,000 times. And all of a sudden you read it and it's like, bam. And you say, that's the answer. That's the answer. All of a sudden it has meaning for you, because your trials and tribulations has put this in some sort of context where it has to do with your life. And all of a sudden it means something to you. And there's this line in the big book, and it says the following. It's Envision for You. Now and then, a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. I feel better. I work better. I'm having a better time. Anybody ever heard that line? You know, when I first heard that line, I'm talking about the first month or two I was sober when I read that line, I didn't understand it. I had no clue as to what they were talking about. Because I figured, this is the way I figure it. I figure if you say, I don't miss it at all, I feel better, you know, I work better, I'm having a better time, I figure that's like, you're like the perfect AA. I feel that's a good, the guy was saying, gee, I want to drink, I'm going nuts, I'm going crazy, I can't stand this thing. I feel I really need help. I figure that's the guy who's got trouble. The guy who says, I feel better, I'm looking better, I'm having a better time. That's the guy who you can be sure he's going to stay sober for 30 years. And then I started sponsoring people. Because I didn't understand what that meant. And I had this guy sponsored, and I talked to him about going to a meeting. He was going to go away, and he says, "Ah, listen, I don't miss it at all. I ain't never going to drink again. Don't even worry about it. I feel better. I look better. I'm having a better time. This thing is great. Don't worry. I'm solid. You don't have to worry about me." And within a week, he was drunk. And I realized that every time I had somebody tell me that he was doing great and he didn't miss it at all and he's never going to drink again, they always drank. And I didn't quite understand why, but I, when you see that happening, when you see that happening over and over and over again, and you meet some guy and he shakes your hand and he says the same exact thing, you start saying, "Oh, this guy ain't going to be right." I mean, you don't want to predict, but I mean, and I start realizing that the guy who says that has not understood the concept of powerlessness. The concept of powerlessness is a subtle sort of thing, you know? Now, I haven't had a drink in almost 37 years, and I don't have a desire to drink tonight. And I do believe, as long as, the grace of God is upon me and I'm in the center of his thinking, and if I'm relying on him and I'm performing the works he wants me to do, I believe I won't drink. But I got to tell you something. There's a part of me that understands that I could be drunk in an hour of this meeting. I mean, I can't explain it. You'll never catch me saying I'm never going to drink again. I don't know whether I'll make it home tonight sober. It's kind of strange, I have this sort of confidence that God will keep me sober, as he always has, as long as I do his will and I focus on him. And I put him number one in my life. Because it told me, it says, "See to it your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others." It tells me all through the book. It says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. It says to me, I can't manage my own life. No human power can help me. Only God could and would if he was sought. And then it says, being convinced, I am now at step three. Thank you, my friend. Thank you, Jay. It says that to me, and I believe it. And I trust it. After the many years of doing it, I believe that God will keep me sober. But on the other hand, I know that I have a disease that's always there, that I'm not cured, and if I somehow defocus from that deal, I could be drunk within an hour. It's like one of these things, I guess you gotta be there. I couldn't explain it to the Kiwanis Club. But it says, now and then a serious drinker being dry. But here's the thing, so I finally sort of understood that. I finally got that deal. Because I started experiencing my own life, I sort of understand the concept that I've never really said nor wanted to say. I mean, I'm scared to say, I ain't never going to drink again, or I'm cured, or anything like that. But it says, but then about many years after that, I got another, I guess would you call it an epiphany, just about this one line. See, that's the crazy thing. I never know what I'm going to say. I can spend an hour just on with this one line. But it's all valid stuff. It says, now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, I don't miss it at all, feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. One of the consequences of being an alcoholic, if you're an alcoholic, you lie to yourself. You tell yourself things like, I don't give a crap what other people think about me, and you spend your entire life worrying about what they're going to think about you. I'm a lawyer, and I've been blessed to have a nice profession. I've made a bunch of money, and I got to tell you something. You're looking at a guy, I've been broke so many times, and you know why? Not because I don't make money, because I spend more money than I make. And when you spend more money than you make, you go into something called debt. And you know why I spend more money than I make? Because I live a dishonest lifestyle. And you know why I live a dishonest lifestyle? Because I'm grandiose. And you know why I'm grandiose? Because I want people to think I'm more successful than I actually am. And you know why I want people to think I'm more successful than I actually am? Because deep down inside, I think I'm a piece of shit. And you know who said that? Carl Menninger in the book Man Against Himself. He said alcoholics in the chapter on chronic suicide. He said, talking about alcoholics, he said they're men and women who are out to destroy themselves. deep down inside, they put up a bit of a big front, but deep down inside, they know they're worthless. They know there's no reason they can think of that justifies their existence on earth. And you know what they say to themselves all the time? If you're an alcoholic, they say to themselves things like, I don't give a crap what other people think about me. Sometimes they'll even say it out loud. They'll say to their friends, I don't give a crap what he thinks about me. But ultimately, you realize if you're an alcoholic, is that's a dead giveaway, as a matter of fact. You know, sometimes I'll be with a guy and says, I don't give a crap what they think about me. And he says, this guy's an alkie. I don't care whether he drinks or not, he's an alkie. He's got my, you know. Because what you realize is that people that really don't give a crap what other people think about them don't say, I don't give a crap what other people think about me. They say things like, pass the sugar, but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? And that can keep you stuck. You know how many people in AA now who are not drinking and go through hours and days of panic and despondency and feeling sorry for themselves and feeling less than and feeling not good enough because of money problems? You know, I understand this crowd's a different kind of crowd. You're a little bit higher on the food chain. But I'm going to tell you something. In the United States of America, there are people that will go for 20 years sucking their thumb and feeling sorry for themselves and worrying at night because of money problems. And you won't hear them talk about it in AA meetings because they're embarrassed. Not that they give a shit what other people think about them, but, you know, because they're embarrassed. And they live a whole life and they don't even know how to deal with that concern and that worry. You understand that? And I had a sponsor who said to me once when I went up to him and I told him about the money thing. he said, well, I got the solution. I said, well, what's the solution? He says, earn more or spend less. And I said, well, what's number three? You know, because I was earning as much as I could earn. I couldn't spend any less. And he'd say, simplify your life. And I'd say, simplify. And I sort of knew what he meant. What he meant was give up the Cadillac, because I was complaining about money, but I was spending $500 to $600 a month on a Cadillac when I could have gotten a used car, you know, or gotten a Chevy for like $200 a month. And he said, why don't you give up the Cadillac? Why don't you come down a little bit on your lifestyle? And I said to myself, I didn't say it to him, and I walked away, I said, he doesn't understand. You ever say to your sponsor or somebody, you don't understand? Sometimes I don't even say it, I just say to myself, he doesn't understand. Because he didn't understand, I can't give up the Cadillac. I didn't even know why I couldn't give up the Cadillac. 9 years sober, I didn't know why I couldn't give up. All I knew was I couldn't give up. I hadn't learned how to. Somehow I'd got to get somebody money from somebody to pay for the Cadillac, to pay for the house, to have all those plates spinning. I couldn't give them up. I didn't even know why I couldn't give them up. I just knew it would be terrible if I had to give them up. But the reason I couldn't give them up is because if I was driving around in a Cadillac and all of a sudden I showed up in a Ford, what would people think? Not that I give a shit what other people think. You understand what I'm saying? Because I don't really give a shit what other people think. You understand? And you know, by the way, you know what that is? Let me tell you what that is. That's alcoholism. You want to know what you suffer from? You don't suffer from it. I've spoken to thousands and thousands of people in AA. Nobody in AA, listen to me, nobody in AA has a drinking problem. You get it? You go to a lot of meetings, have you noticed that nobody's drunk and nobody has a drinking problem? They have a, I don't care what other people think about me problem. I just told you insight into what alcoholism is and how it affects you today, and you don't even know it. It's like a subtle thing. So it says, going back to our script, it says, we know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life with or without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness as few do. He will be at the jumping off place he will wish for the end. Now, here's the epiphany I had around 15 or 20 years. I used to think, and it probably does to a certain extent, that they were talking about newcomers, guys that had like a month or 2 months or 3 months sobriety. But after being sober for 10, 15, 20 years and sponsoring people that have been sober, I realized that this applies to somebody who's got 15 years. Some guy with 20 years who says, I don't have a drinking problem at all. I feel better. I look better. Get off my back. Everything's okay. But he's living a life of quiet desperation. he's not happy with his sobriety. You know, sometimes people will ask me, they'll hear about it. I've seen him drink at 30 years. And they'll ask me, why do you think Joe drank? I said, I know why he drank. So you know why? I said, I know why Joe drank. I said, why did he drink? He wasn't happy with his sobriety. People who are grateful and happy with their sobriety. Bill Wilson said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease. I got to keep on talking about it and telling other people. He was grateful for his sobriety. Bill Dotson said, you know, that was the golden text for him. A man who was so excited and grateful about his sobriety and happy about being sober. You know, that a happy alcoholic who's happy, not because he has a new car, not because he has a girlfriend, he's just happy and grateful that he's sober today, you know, and doing God's work. He's happy about, you know, they said a guy followed Mother Teresa around in the slums of India, and from New York Times, and he said to Mother Teresa, if he saw the day that she went through feeding the poor, he said, you know, I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million. And Mother Teresa turned to me and says, neither would I. She was doing it because she felt called by God to do that. That's exactly what she was supposed to do. And a grateful and happy alcoholic won't drink again. If you see an alcoholic drink, it's because he's not happy with his sobriety. He may give you, and inwardly we do fool ourselves. That's part of the deal. So in any event, I'm going to spend a little time on what it's like and then go into what happened and what it's. I want to tell you a couple of stories. You know, one of the things is when you first come into AA, you don't really have a story. I mean, your story is like, you know, it's my ex-wife's fault, it's my boss's fault, it's my friend's fault, you know, it's the world's fault. You don't know anything, but you don't know what the heck's going on. Well, I came to AA, here's why I came to AA, because I couldn't stop. How many people couldn't stop drinking? You suffer, anybody here suffer from that I can't stop drinking thing, you know? I'm 31 years old. I think, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to have a drink today. By 5 o'clock, I'm drunk. I wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to buy booze today. By 5 o'clock, I'm searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters so I can get a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Cante and sit by the phonograph and play. We used to have LP record. You know what an LP record is. Some of you guys, you know, David, you know what an LP record is. Hell, you were around when they were crossing the Red Sea, you know, but in any event. Yeah. But you and I, you know. But I'd sit around and I'd play these LP records with Alky songs. Anybody know? I had Alky songs. Listen. I'm also a self-pity alcohol. I'm a self-pityaholic. I don't need music to get into self-pity, but it helps. You know, I have certain songs. I had, when I first got sober, if one of my Alky songs came on the radio, one of the things I had to do, you know, it says go to Annie Lake, is I had to turn off the freaking music. I couldn't listen to the song. The song, you know, it's like some of my Alky songs was Only the Lonely, I'm Mr. Blue, Rainy Days and Mondays, Running on Empty was always a good one. You know, Pirate Looks at 40, you know. I had all these Alky songs. So I'd sit there with my bottle, you know, and I'd play the same song. And back then, it wasn't like CDs. You couldn't program it. You would listen to the Alky song, you know what I mean? And then, and you'd be drinking, and I'd be drinking, and drinking and thinking. And then I'd get to the end of the song, and then I'd have to be awake and aware enough so I could lift up the needle and move it back again so I could listen to it again. And I'd always, it was always the same kind of deal. I'd picture my funeral. I'd be singing the song in a bar like I was Jimmy Buffett, because Alkies have really good imaginations, you know what I mean? Like I was Jimmy Buffett. All my former girlfriends were there. You know, underline the word former. All my former girlfriends were there, and they were saying things to themselves because I could hear them like, oh, I wish I was back with him again. Then I'd go straight from there. Sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like. Then I'd go from there to my funeral. And I'd be like lying there in the box, and all these gals would be around me and, you know, feeling really, really bad for how they treated me. You know, and the bitches deserved it because they didn't treat me nice at all. Let me tell you something like that. And they'd be feeling really bad. Of course, I wasn't really dead, you understand? I mean, I was in the coffin, but I was actually behind the tree. You understand? And that's how I basically live my life almost every day with a bottle. And I was 31 years old and I was a practicing attorney. So I wasn't doing so well, okay? And you know, and so I would every morning I'd get up and say, I'm not gonna drink, and then I drink, I'm not gonna drink, and then I drink, and then finally just give up. I said, I can't stop drinking, I couldn't envision life without drinking. So when I finally came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I came in because I couldn't stop. I said to the guy, I need help, I can't stop drinking. Now I'm going to tell you a little something because it has to do with the end of this deal, and I'm just going to tell you the truth. Whatever it is, you don't have to get mad or get upset, but I'm just going to tell you the truth. When I was I got sober on January 25th, 1981.
But my spiritual bottom was December 25th, 1980. Because on December 25th, 1980, I had been married. I'm sort of skipping ahead and I'm going back and forth. Anybody ever see the movie Pulp Fiction? You know how he starts in the middle and goes to the end and goes back? It's sort of like my talks, you know what I mean? But so you got to stay awake, you know, because I'll make a hard right turn. You'll say, what's he talking about? I'll come back again. So I, on December 25th, 1980, after a lot of drinking, a lot of stuff, I walked away from marriage. I walked away from a son. I walked away from a house. I dumped everything. And that's a whole other story, which I'll get into somewhere. But and I found myself, I had gone to a party with a gal named Daisy, a Noche Buena, which is like a thing they do the night before, the 24th night before Christmas in Miami. And I got kicked out because I was drunk. I was drunk before I got to the party. And so I was alone in my, quote, bachelor pad, because my plan was going to be the Hugh Hefner of Miami, you know, and but because of bad breaks and misunderstandings, it didn't quite work out. But anyway, I was alone in my bachelor pad, listening to that music, you know what I mean, on Christmas Eve. And if you know anything about alcoholism, you know a little bit about loneliness. There ain't nothing, because you know that everybody else in the world has somebody. You know what I mean? And you're the only one on the planet that has nobody. And you're there alone on Christmas, and I'm sitting there, and I thought my life is over, and I knew loneliness was futile. I was at that jumping off place, and a guy comes on TV around 2 o'clock in the morning, some preacher, and he talks about changing your life if you're down. I mean, you know, they must know they're talking to alcoholics, and he says, if you want to change your life, he starts talking about, and he gave a little testimony about himself and what happened to him and what it was like for him, and then he started talking about giving your life to Jesus Christ. And he said, if you want to change your life, get down on your knees, and ask God, and he did the sinner's prayer. If you don't know the sinner's prayer, I'm not going to pray, but it's basically like the third step prayer, you know? And it says, you ask the Lord to come into your life and change your life and Lord and Savior, all that. And so, and I got down on my knees, and I repeated the sinner's prayer, and that's what I did. That was my deal, which may not be a big deal to you, but to a Jewish kid from New York, let me tell you something, it's a major situation, okay? But I mean, you'd be surprised as what you'll do. And you want to know what's funny? I got down on my knees, and I gave my life to Jesus, you know what I mean? And I got up, and 1 month later, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. 1 month later, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a month after that, they were talking about doing the third step prayer, and I said, I don't know whether I want to do that thing. You know, I had some money in the bank, you know what I mean? Got my job, you know, my girlfriend back. I said, I don't know what I want. I don't know. I'm worried about this God thing. You know what I'm talking about? But I can tell you this, at 3 o'clock in the morning, on December 25th, 19, on Christmas morning, December 25th, 1980, I had no problem getting on my knees and saying, God help me. I had no problem. You know what I've been trying to do for the last 37 years? I've been trying to get back to that mindset. I've been trying to get back to that mindset, to that humility, to that deal I had on December 25th, 1980. When I was 15, we're going back now, I found a Playboy magazine. Any of you guys ever read Playboy? I never read it, but I found it, and I immediately opened it up. That was my first addiction, by the way, not booze. My first addiction was the woman. I opened it up, I saw this gal, you know, the deal, the centerfold. And I immediately knew, I don't know how you know this as a guy, you know, Jesse, you won't even understand. What are you, you're like 10 years old, you're going to have to leave, you can't hear this. I don't want you to, you know. I immediately knew what would fix me. You understand what I'm saying? I knew what would fix me. If I had one of them bunny things, and she loved me, and she adored me, and believe me, I chased that thing, I chased that stuff, I was a lounge lizard, believe me, I wanted what she had, I was willing to go to any length to get it. I was that deal. And so for the rest of my life, I looked for that deal, for the gal that would love me and adore me and all that sort of stuff. But I had one problem, I was scared to talk to women. It's really hard to get a date, you know what I mean? Or to get, if you're scared to talk, but you know what? I would go whack with a couple of those drinks in the bar, and I became like Brad Pitt on steroids. You understand what I'm saying? That's what it did for me. That's what my deal was. And so one day I'm in college. I'm in undergraduate school. I think it was my last year. And some gal walks in, and I look at her, and you know, I look at her deal and everything like that. I said, man, if I was an if only or in a yes butter. If I only had this, if I only had, I was always looking for something that was gonna, there was, if you're an alcoholic, you're always looking for something that's gonna change your life. I said, man, if I had this car, it would change my life. If I had this gal, it would change my life. If I was living in Calgary, man, that would be it. I would change my, if I could only live in Calgary, it would change my, if I could only lose 50 pounds, it would change it. I was always, if I only had that shirt, if I only had that suit, you know, if I could only dye my hair green, you know, it would change my life, you know. I was always trying to look at these things, and you could get them immediately, you could buy them, I would mortgage my house, I would do anything else to get that one thing, because that was going to propel me to stardom, and that was going to change my life. And you want to know something? It would work. It would work for like an hour, you know. And then it was a used car, you know, but or whatever it was. And so I said, if I could only have this gal, and so in true alcoholic fashion, I just went after her like with harpoons, you know what I mean? And I wanted on her and her parents and everything like that. She's a nice gal, and we got married and had a baby, a beautiful baby, and he's like 40-something years old today. We're going up to give me two lovely grandchildren. I got 7 grandchildren now. By the way, I have pictures. I have pictures of my grandchildren, which I'd like to show you after this. I really think that I should have a screen so I can show you all my kids and grandkids. But in any event, so, and I married her, and within 2 years, I was sitting in the bars drinking, looking at the gals. I was sitting in the bars drinking, looking at the gals. Let me tell you why that happened. One day I came home, when I was about 18 years, now we're going back, when I was 18 years old, 18, 19, or 20, these new cars came to the market. They were Camaros. Camaros and Firebirds, and they were so cool, you couldn't believe them. And I said to myself, I looked at this car, I'd seen the billboards, I saw the commercials, and this is what I said to myself. If I could get one of those cars, that would be a life changer. You understand what I'm saying? Because I don't know what it is. There's something about me, inside of me, part of being an alcoholic, one of the consequences is, and I'm not talking about you, I'm just talking about me, is deep down inside, somehow you think you're worthless. You understand the word worthless? You think you're worthless. When you're in the shower and you're lathering up, and all of a sudden you hear this voice, you're a piece of crap, you might as well kill yourself. And you turn around to see who's saying that shit to you, and you're the only one in the shower. You know what I mean? When you're driving along, you're saying you're condemning yourself for being an idiot and being stupid and having a crummy life and you're not worth anything. You know, those voices, they're not coming from like Jupiter or something. I mean, you can turn on the radio, you can turn on TV, you can text, you can talk to people, you can go to the movies, you can drink, you can do a whole lot of things to try to drown out those voices, and maybe they'll go away for a while, but they always come back. And it's some sort of voice that sort of tells you, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm always going to be a nothing. I used to put something in my body, I turned into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is top of the world. And that's what alcohol did for me. And the bottom line is, so when I was about 18 or 19 or 20 years old, I can't remember the exact date, the bottom line is these Camaros came on the market. And I said, I just knew, because if you're an alcoholic like me, you're never going to be something by yourself because you're worthless. So you got to get accoutrements. You got to be an alcoholic with a Rolex watch. You got to be an alcoholic with a Mercedes. You got to be an alcoholic with a Camaro. You got to be an alcoholic with a... You got to add stuff so that the world knows you're not a worthless piece of crap. You understand? You got to go after that stuff, okay? And let me tell you something. There are consequences to living your life running after stuff. You know, Bill Wilson said the real problem with alcoholism is unhealthy dependencies. There's a consequence to living your life making the stuff in this world your God. There's a consequence to buying in. I know the TV tells you if you only had this, you'd be okay. I know the TV tells you if you're 80 years old and you can't get a hard-on for 4 hours, you take Viagra. Because if you're not making love at 80 years old like you did when you're 18, you're a piece of crap. I know they're telling you all that stuff in the movies in order to sell stuff to you. But I'm telling you, if you buy into that stuff, and it's hard not to say, why don't I have this, and why can't I have that, and why aren't I as good as this, when all the movie stars and everybody around you tell you you're a piece of crap, you don't have it. It's hard not to buy into that stuff. But when you buy into that life, there's a consequence to buying into that life, and the consequence is sitting around, if you don't have it, thinking about what a piece of crap you are, and if you do have it, trying to figure out how to keep it, and worried about what happens if you lose it, and there's a consequence, and the consequence is never being happy. Never being happy. Drunk or sober, never being happy. And so I went out and I took all the money I had, just inherited some money, and I went out and I put it down on that Camaro. And you know, I had, I think it was like $10,000. I had like $4,000, whatever it is. I put it down. I financed the rest over 36 months. And he said, well, you got to come. It was Friday. He said, you got, well, I'll take the car because I wanted it now. You know, I want that suit of clothes now. I want that thing now. And I went down and I get that car. And he says to me, he says, no, he says, you got to come back. I said, what do you mean tomorrow? He says, well, we got to prep it. It's something called prep. I said, what do you mean? He says, you paid for it. I get it so long. You got to prep it. I said, no, I'll take it. He says, you got to come back tomorrow. At 9:30, we'll give you the car. So I was there at like 8:30, you know, because I knew if I had the Camaro, I could get, Jake, if I had the Camaro, I could get the what? The girl. See? I like your thinking. I like your thinking. Okay, so that's why we're in the same meeting together, because you think like I think. Okay, I can get the girl, because without the Camaro, I can't get the girl, because what girl's going to look at me? I'm a piece of shit. Even though I don't give a shit what other people think about it. So, in any event, the bottom line is, this is all about alcoholism, by the way. I just want you to know. I know I'm not talking about booze, but in any event, so, but this is why I drank. This is what actually leads up to the drink. You know, so I went down and I got the car on Saturday, and I dropped, and I'm about 150 pounds less than I am right now. And I've got on a t-shirt, and I'm working out, and I got the sunglasses on. I got my rolled up in my sleeve. I got Camel cigarettes. I got a cigarette hanging. I'm like James Dean. I get in that car. I put the windows down. I'm driving down Alton Road in Miami Beach. There was nobody on the road. I'm thinking the entire world is looking at me. I don't know if you ever had a new car. I'm thinking every woman in China is looking at me. Like it's Google Earth. They're like focusing on me. Okay. I come to the first light. Okay. The first light. And some guy pulls up to me. A brand new Cadillac. And I'm low to the ground, and he's up here, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I look at him again, and sitting next to him is the Playboy Bunny. And the first thought I had was, why can't I have a Cadillac? The feeling of having that new car lasted 3 blocks. The payments lasted 36 months. But that feeling was so strong, it kept me trying to get new cars. Every year I had to get a new car. Every year, you know, if I got a scratch in that car, and it cost $300 to fix that scratch, and I only had $300 in the bank, I would spend that $300, even if I needed it, because I can't drive a car with a scratch in it, because it's like, if people see me with a car with a scratch in it, it's like I'm imperfect. So I got to have the perfect car and the perfect everything. I mean, so people will think that not that I give a shit what other people think about it. You understand what I'm saying? But it's just the way. And so what happened was, when I got married to this gal, and there was nothing wrong with her, and nothing like I was an assistant state attorney. I was division chief over at the state attorney's office. Had a great job. Had this nice wife. Had a beautiful son. Had a beautiful house on Miami Beach, on the golf course. I had everything that one would think you need to be okay. And within 2 years, I'm in the bars looking at the gals saying, if I only had one of those. And you know why I was doing that? See, I didn't know why I was doing that. I just knew I was doing that because when you're alcoholic, you know, I'm doing that because she was like the Camaro. She was like, you see, I thought, remember I said, if I only had that woman, I'd be okay. I'd never ask for anything like anything else. And within 2 years, I was going, why can't I have that deal? And so one day she said, come home drunk one more time. One day this gal, because my deal was I would come home almost every night drunk. She'd be fixing dinner and I'd come home drunk, and I'm not going to go through that whole story. And one day she said to me on a Friday, she looked me in the eye, it was like she was delivering the mail, she wasn't starting a fight. She said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. That's what she said. She wasn't starting a fight, she wasn't saying it, she was like almost like delivering the mail. She says, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. We've been married 5 years, and I said, okay, I heard that, I got it. It's like, it's 12 words. There's no fat in it. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. There's no fat in that deal, you know what I mean? You can't take a word out of it, you know? And it's like, and I'm a lawyer, I'm a practicing attorney, I'm trying murder cases, I mean, I'm not stupid. And I get in my car, and I drive 3 blocks, I get to the first light, and this is what I thought. What the hell does she mean by that? Because when you're an alcoholic, one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is when you hear something or read something or is told something that you don't like, it confuses you. You don't quite understand it. I mean, what the hell could she mean by that statement if you come home drunk one more time? So that day, I didn't forget it. That day I went to the bar with my drinking buddies. It was 4:30 in the afternoon. I turned to my buddy Doug and I said, I can't stay because I have to get home because Ronnie told me if I come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And he put his arm around me, as drinking buddies do, and he said, Russ, she's never going to leave you. She loves you. You're the greatest guy in the world. And I'm thinking, that's why I love these guys. Because that's what I'm thinking, you know what I mean? I'm thinking that, you know? But I said, I'm only going to stay for one drink. So I ordered my one drink. It was a double scotch. I didn't realize I was already at two. And I went, whack. I drank for the double water again. But I drank to get to that place. I didn't drink for the taste. I drank, whack. You know, if I could have put it with a needle, I just whack. And it was 4:30. My house was only 50 minutes away. It was 4:30. And I went, whack. And now it was 4:30 and 30 seconds. I ordered another drink. I said, whack. Next thing I know, I'm home at 4 o'clock in the morning. Next thing that happened is I'm kicked out of the house. And that was the end of a five-year marriage. And it was like a couple of years. I was 6 months in AA before I realized that my divorce had something to do with drinking. That's why I thought we were growing in different directions. She didn't understand me. I didn't understand her. And she said, come home drunk one more time. Leave me. I came home drunk. She left me. And you want to know something? Let me tell you something. She tried to make it work. We went to a marriage counselor. And the marriage counselor said to her, I guess she went to this marriage counselor school, what are the three things you want to change about Russell? And she said, I felt I had to go because I felt sort of guilty, because I was guilty, you know, and I felt like I had to, you know, and try to at least make a showing that I was trying to make it work, but I'd already had my sights on the next gal, you know what I mean? And I was already saying that, you know, I felt like I was in that movie, The Godfather. I tried to get out of it, dragged me. I knew this wasn't going to end well. And he's asked, I wasn't even paying attention. He says, what's the three things you want to change with Russell? And she said a couple of things. And I think one of the things she said was, I think she said something like not drinking, coming home for dinner or something. And then he turned to me and said, Russell, what's the three things you want to change with Ronnie? And I looked at him and I said, I just want to date other women. I said that, I was sober as I am right now. And I said, I just want to date other women. And that was the end of the session. It wasn't until 10 years later that I realized for the first time how that must have hurt her. To make a long story really short and to rush through this thing, one of the things that happens is after you get in here and after you experience some of the stuff that you experience in here, and after you hear some of the people you hear, you start realizing and you start remembering things that happened in your past. You start connecting the dots. And then you start realizing who you are and what you are. Your stories. Our stories disclose in a drum way what we used to be like. My stories disclose to me what's going on. They tell me what's happening, who I am and what I am. So I have a lot of stories. I never have time. I would never have time to tell them all, but I'm just going to tell you a couple of them. So on January 25th, 1981, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up a white chip. I got a sponsor. And I've had three sponsors, you know, and all wonderful people. All of them, I think, one of them's on his deathbed now. He's in hospice. That's my third one. All wonderful, incredible people. And I got married when I was 3 months old to my lovely, fantastic wife who's sitting right there. Woo! You want to stand up, honey, or would you like 15 minutes in rebuttal? She's a member of Al-Anon, Our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge, you know? I don't have to worry about doing inventory. She does great Al-Anon tech stuff. When I'm wrong, she probably admits it, you know? So we've been married for almost 37 years now, and we've got four kids and seven grandkids, and it's incredible. It's just a wonderful deal. So I'm not here to talk to you about relationships or not to get married and all that sort of stuff. But I can tell you this, I'll tell you a couple things about that deal. I'm going to tell you just a couple of stories, sober stories, because I want to talk about what it's like now. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor, I'm sitting with my sponsor, Amy, and of course, I already told you who I am, and I'm sitting there, and I'm sober, and I'm looking at the blonde in the front row, and I say to my sponsor, because this is the way I am, this is the way I talk, I said, look at the blonde in the front row, because all my life, I'm a lounger, all my life. All the only thing I've been ever doing is saying, look at that blonde in the front row, you know? They're my higher power. And my sponsor said, Russell, what'd you used to drink? I said, I drank scotch. He said, what kind of scotch? I said, James B. He said, you see that blonde in the front row? I said, yeah, I see her. He said, for you, that's a bottle of J&B legs. And I sort of tried, did one of these nervous chuckles. And the next time I saw her, you know they, what they do is they brainwash. I told him, I said, I know you do. Your brainwash needs, maybe your brain needs washing. You know, I mean, and next time I saw her, I saw her, she looked pretty good, and then all of a sudden this green bottle formed around her. You know what I mean? Because one thing I had going for me, and maybe the only thing I had going for me, is more than anything, I didn't want to drink. You know, that blonde was looking good, but I didn't want to drink. You know, I mean, there was a lot of things up, but I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to do anything to put my sobriety. The way I was taught when I came to AA, as a matter of fact, is that, not that you can always come back. I was never taught you can always come back. I knew you could come back, because I'd seen people come back. I was taught, it was my understanding, that if I drank, I probably wouldn't make it back. That's what I was taught. If I drank, I probably, thank God, because that's what I needed to hear. So, I'm just going to tell you, because we're light on time, I'm just going to tell you a couple of stories. I will tell you, there is one story I think is important, a couple of stories I think are important. I was driving with my first sponsor in the car. When I was sponsored, my first sponsor, Bob Sullivan, sponsored me and a guy named Bobby. Now, this gets a little confusing. Bob Sullivan sponsored me and a guy named Bobby. I picked up a white chip. I never drank after that. You know, I don't take any credit for that. I give God all the credit. Bobby was one of these guys that every 30 days he would drink. Every once in a while you run into people like that. It's just every 30 days they drink. They're great for 30 days and then they drink. And Bobby would say to me, he says, Russ, you're an alcoholic, but I'm an alcoholic. I got that 30-day thing. Oh, okay. So I'm going to just tell you three stories. So Bobby would say, I'm an alcoholic. What would happen is every month we would drive up to the facility where Bobby would go to a place called BARC. It was Broward County Recovery Center. And we'd have to pick Bobby up at the Broward County Recovery Center and bring him down. And we did this every month for 4 months. He would stay sober for 30 days, and I would get in the car with my sponsor and drive up to pick up Bobby, who after 30 days would get drunk again. Now, you got to understand this. I wasn't a dummy, okay? I mean, I was a pretty smart guy, but in my own opinion. You know, I was educated far beyond. I had my sponsor once in my office. And I graduated with Departmental Honors in Mathematics. I was a National Science Foundation Fellow. I was going for my PhD in algebra and topology. I became a division chief for Janet Reno in the state's attorney's office, one of the largest prosecution offices in the United States, actually. And I had this office when I was in private practice, and on the wall, it still has 40 diplomas and certificates proving I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And I have Bobby, my sponsor. I should have been sponsored by Albert Einstein. He was dead, or Jesus, or something. And I got Bobby there, my sponsor, who's like a used car salesman. Didn't even graduate the sixth grade, okay? And I'm sitting there, and I say to Bob, my sponsor, I'm like 3 or 4 months sober. I look at him, I say, Bob, these are my degrees. And he says, well, you know, Russell, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. So I'm not going to tell you all the stories, but I want you to understand that will indicate to you the kind of relationship I had with all my sponsors. It was sort of like I had a sign on me that said, "Kick me, I'm an idiot," and they took great pleasure in doing that with sarcasm. And you know something? That's what I needed. I need somebody to constantly put me in my place, you know? And so I got a million stories about how I would do something. I remember one time my sponsor said, you know, Russ, because I told him I didn't want to go crazy with this thing. I want balance in my life. I didn't want to go crazy with this anything. So I said, I figured out that I don't have to go to meetings on Thursdays. So I said, Bob, I don't believe I have to go to meetings on Thursdays, you know? And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, that's cool. He said, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. But I drank on Thursday, and then he looked at me and he said, Russell, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. And I sat there. I was 31 years old. I had all those degrees, and I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. I had never heard anything like that said to anybody. I certainly had never had anybody say anything like that to me. And I had to sit there with all the PhDs and the JD and the drill, and I had to sit there, and I was sitting there trying to figure out what he had just said to me. You know as much about life as a dog knows about, because I was thinking maybe he was complimenting me. You know? And what I did, I swear to God, what I did, and I was sober 3 months, I started picturing, there's this RCA dog. If you ever see RCA, they have this like little dog. I pictured like a doggy family. Like a doggy mommy, and a doggy daddy, and a doggy kid. And all of a sudden, it came and says, wait a second, a dog doesn't know his father. You know what I mean? That's like, so that's how bad it was with me. And in any event, so we're on our fourth trip now, going up to Bark to pick up Bobby. Remember that? I'm in the car to pick up Bobby. And this is a fourth trip that this guy has gone out and drank again. And I'm like stark raving sober. I mean, let me tell you something. I'm taking notes. You know what I mean? I've got 3x5 cards. I got photographs. I mean, this guy's a phony. He's full of crap. He's hurting my sponsor. And my sponsor's got like 20 years. He's just too stupid to understand what's going on here. He's like alky stupid. Like, you know, he ought to die because he's just so stupid. And so I say to him, I start with my opening statement. I said, Bob, I said, we ought to turn this car around. Turn this car around. He said, not even pick him up. He says, this guy is a phony. We did this last month. We did it the month before. He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about me. He's just wasting our time. He never intends to drink. He's constantly incapable. This is bullshit. We got to turn this car around and just leave him there and the hell with him. And I said, you know, and I was, as I was talking, I was getting myself, I was like my own lynch mob. I was getting myself, you know, yeah, let's kill him, you know. It is going to be, shoot him, you know. I'm getting madder and madder. I'm yelling and screaming. And says, turn this car around. This is bullshit, blah, blah, blah. And you want to tell me, I was probably right. I was probably right, you know, and I was getting all that. And you know, I mean, I had the photograph. I mean, I was absolutely right. And I mean, what's he going to say to me? He never even graduated sixth grade. I'm a lawyer. I had all the evidence. It was all marked. All the news. I was right. I was right. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you finished?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm finished. I'm finished." He says, "No. Are you finished?" Because I really wasn't finished. Because once you start that locomotive going on, you're lynching somebody. Now I have the whole crowd in my fucking mind. You know what I mean? We're gonna kill him. We're gonna get him. But finally, he says, "I have 3 months." You know. Sometimes I call this fellowship the fellowship of the very nervous. You know what I mean? I was nervous. I was upset. You know, you ever been upset? I was a little upset. I was upset. You know, the way he was treating me. You know, don't treat me like that. Like I'm an idiot. You know what I mean? I may know I'm an idiot, but don't treat me like an idiot. I may think I'm an idiot. He said to me, he says, "No, Russ, are you finished? Are you finished?" He says, yes. He says, I'm finished. I mean, what's he going to say? There's nothing he can say to me. This is what, he waited about 2 minutes and then he said this. This is what he said to me. He looked at me and he said this. I'll never forget it. It's one of these turning points. He said, "Russell." I said, "What?" He says, "Russell." I said, What? He said, "It doesn't bother me like it bothers you." But everything bothers me. You see, I wanted everything he had. He wanted nothing I had. He used to have what I had. 9 years later, he had died, he had passed away, and I had a second sponsor, a wonderful man named Joe Snyder. And I had been working the program hard for 9 years, doing all the stuff, Intergroup Banquet Chairman for 2 years in a row, secretary of the group, you know, on relay for 8 years, the whole bit, you know, the whole deal. You know, I'm not saying I was perfect, but I was working this thing, going to meetings, you know, the whole bit, working the steps. 9 years later, my wife, the lovely Digna, and I want to confess right now, it was probably all my fault, okay? No, it was all my fault, but my wife, we got into a fight. And I don't know what she, and I called up my sponsor, Joe.
And I said, and I started telling him what just happened. I said, hey, this marriage is over. This is over. He said, what's the problem? He says, well, she said this, and I said that. She said this, and then she said this, and then she did that, and then she did this. And I told him exactly what happened. I mean, exactly what happened. Let me tell you, has anybody here been upset? Anybody, raise your hand if you've been upset. Let me ask this. Isn't it true that when you're upset, isn't this true? You know exactly why you're upset. Yeah, you know exactly why you're upset, right? I mean, you may not know much, but you know why. You know so much why you're upset that you'll even go to your group and say, you'll even tell them why. You'll tell the first person you meet on the street why you're upset. You'll tell your spouse why. You may not know much, but you know why. I told him exactly what happened, truthfully what happed. I said, I didn't sign on for this crap. This is bullshit. I told him the whole thing. So Joe says the following to me. He said, do you know why you're upset? I said, what? He said, do you know why you're upset? I said, yeah, of course I know why I'm upset. He said, why are you upset? I said, Joe, I just spent 20 minutes telling you exactly what she said and what she did. You know what I mean? I'll tell you one thing. The guys at the bar would have known why I was upset. And I said, I told you exactly why I'm upset. And then he says this to me. He says, that's not why you're upset. I said, that's not why I'm upset. He said, no, that's not why you're upset. What I just told you, that's not why I'm upset. He said, no, that's not why I'm upset. All that stuff I just told you, what she did, that's not why I'm upset. He said, no, that's not why you're upset at all. And then he shut up. He didn't say, let me tell you why you're upset. He didn't say a thing. And so finally, well, what are you going to do? I said to him, I said, well, you know why I'm upset? He said, absolutely. I said, you know why I'm upset? I said, absolutely. He said, absolutely. I said, well, are you going to tell me why I'm upset? He says, do you really want to know? I said, of course I want to know. Why am I upset? And then he said this, in exactly these words. He said, listen, stupid. Like a loving thing he used to say to me. He says, listen, stupid. You're upset because you're upsettable. I said, what is this, like Zen-AA or something? You know, you want to know something? That's exactly what my first sponsor said to me 9 years prior to that. Remember what he said to me? I told him about a situation that happened in my life, and I told it to him truthfully. And you want to know something? I was probably right about Bobby. And you know what he said to me? He said, Russ, you see, it bothers you. It doesn't bother me. You're upset, but I'm not. 9 years later, after everything I did in AA, I'm still the dumb-sucking crybaby. I'm still letting everything in this world and things in this world I have no control over, my wife's moods, whatever she says, the weather, who's elected president, who's not elected, whatever it is, I'm still letting it drive me crazy. And he said to me, Russell, you're upset not because of the circumstances. You're upset because you're upsettable. You know, in the book of James, which is, we were almost called the James Club, in chapter 1 of the book of James, he says, rejoice or be happy whenever you have trials. You know, when we have trials, we go to A meetings and we complain about it, or we go to our sponsor and complain about it. It says in the book of James, rejoice whenever you have trials of many kinds. Because when you persevere and you focus on God throughout these trials, he says, it builds up an enduring faith, a faith that works really in rough going. And every time I've been through a trial, and every time I've been through a situation that I thought was going to kill me, every time I've gotten upset, every time something's happened in my life where I have no power over it, and I want to scream and I want to yell, you know, when I don't want to drink, what I end up doing is inventorying it, talking to my sponsor, praying about it, and somehow it sort of like goes away. And I had to do that over and over and over again, 5,000 times a year for 30, you know what happens when you go through a lot of trials and tribulations that upset you, and you're constantly sort of trying to work on not being upset or trying to lose the resentment? What happens is you find yourself in situations that used to upset you, and you've been through it so many times, you prayed about it so many times, and you asked God to relieve it so many times, that slowly but surely, all of a sudden, at 10 years or 15 years or 20 years sober, the thing that used to drive you crazy doesn't even bother you anymore. You know what happens in 20 years? In 20 years, the thing that bothers you, you don't even realize it's happened because you're not even paying attention to it. You're not even paying attention. You know, sometimes I'll be at home and I'll be with one of my sponsees who's having a marital problem, and what somebody will, maybe my wife will say something to me, or you know, my wife, she'll say something to me, and the guy will turn to me and say, "Did you hear what she just said?" And I'll say, "No, what?" What did she say? I have a little granddaughter, a little granddaughter. Her name's Andrea. She's about this tall. She's cute as a bunny. When she was about 5 years old, I'm sitting there at my computer, you know what I mean, in my house, and she comes up to me, my wife's in the kitchen, and she comes up and says, "Grandpa," she says, "what kind of fish are you?" I said, "What, Andrea?" She says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "What kind of fish am I?" She says, "Yo, what kind of fish are you?" I said, "Well, I don't know, Andrea. What kind of fish am I?" She says, "You're a selfish." My wife's back in the kitchen laughing, you know. That's my life we're talking, you're laughing about. Okay, this is the last story. This is like a, I'm going to tell you the story because this happened last August. So this is like a recent thing. This is like a 36-year deal, okay? This is a little bit about alcoholism. This is me at 36 years. Because it has to do with a bunch of things. It has to do with money and all sorts of stuff, you know. So it's my wife's birthday. And she was, this is your last birthday. I think it was your last birthday or the birthday before that. She was like 45 years old. 45. Well, you know, she's been 40 for the last 10 years, so she jacked up to 45. But, you know, but anyway. It was her point. She said, "I'm 45. I said, "How old are you?" She said, "I'm 45 this year." Okay, so she's 45 this year. So I said, "What do you want to do?" So she says, "I want to," because I sort of knew what she wanted to do. She says, "I want to go out with all the kids and the grandkids to a restaurant, you know, a nice restaurant, you know, and, you know, tablecloths and all that." So I pretty much knew that was going to happen. And, I tell her, pick out a restaurant. So she calls up my other daughter, one of my daughters. I have three daughters to do that. And they pick out a restaurant. Of course, they pick out one of the most expensive restaurants in Miami, and which is okay. Okay, I mean, I got the plastic. You understand what I'm saying? I'm already through this thing. I've already figured out in my mind it's going to cost me X amount, and, you know, blah blah blah. And I'm not going to let it bother me. And, you know, it is what it is. And this is what you got to do. And when I go out, you got to understand. I got four kids, seven grandkids, six grandkids. I mean, I go out. It's like taking the 101st Airborne out. You understand? We're not talking two. We're talking about 10 or 12 people. You know, we're going out. And so we go to this restaurant. They set aside a room for us. I'm looking at the menu, and I've got to admit, I got to be honest with you. I mean, I make a pretty good living. You know, I'm not wealthy by any means, but I'm looking at the menu, and I'm like, I'm doing the addition shit. You know, I'm like the advocates. You know, I'm doing, well, it's $50 a person times multiplying. I'm trying to figure out what this is going to, you know, run me. You know, and because I'm there, I'm the wallet. You understand what I'm saying? So I'm there, and. And my kids, you know, and my kids aren't alcoholic or anything. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I hear Andrea. Remember Andrea? She's like 5 years old. She says, "Monty, can I have a shrimp cocktail?" I'm looking at shrimp cocktails, $25. And my daughter says, "Yeah, honey, Grandpa will pay for it. Don't worry, you can have a shrimp cocktail." And then it's $25. She takes one bite of the shrimp. She says, "Ooh, I hate that." You know what I mean? And then my kids said, "Yeah, we'll take another bottle of wine." You know what I mean? It's $100. You know, and I'm like adding to my mind, you know how much. You know, I'm like my mind. You know, I'm not showing it. I'm like I'm smiling. Everybody's having a great time. It's great to eat. But I'm going to tell you something. I'm doing the addition, the calculation. You know, and so at the end of the dinner, they bring me the bill. You know, it's the gross national product of Peru. You know, and I sign off. You know, because I'm always worried. In the back of my mind, I'm always thinking there's some guy at American Express. Even though I got a platinum, there's a guy at American Express saying, "Russell's saying that guy. You gave that guy a card." I'm always thinking they're gonna come up and say, "I'm sorry, they declined it. They didn't know it was you." That kind of thing's gonna happen. I'm gonna be washing dishes, and you know, what do people think if I'm washing? Not that I give a shit. So I sign the thing. Everybody has a wonderful time, and I get in the car with my wife and my daughter Vanessa. Vanessa, my nickname for her is Toka.
T-O-C-A, the one who craves attention. Vanessa gets in the car with us, and we're driving home, and I got to tell you something. I am a coffeeaholic. If I'm anything, I'm a coffeeaholic. I'm a coffee nut, like a high test, caffeine, you know? And so we're driving home, and I happen to mention, I said, we're out of coffee. And I said, we're out of coffee, and I need to get coffee. And there's only one kind of coffee I get, and that is, it's called, I think it's called Folgers Colombian Coffee, okay? It's like, and Folgers has these, like markings, like the pizzazz stuff is like marked yellow, and then they have beige, and they have dark, and then there's like dark, you know, it's like death coffee, you know? And I said, that's the stuff I drink. And so we're driving home, and I said, I need to get coffee. And Vanessa said, Dad, pull up to Publix, which is our like shopping, our, what is it? Grocery store. Pull up to Publix, I'll run out, I'll get you coffee. I said, you'll get me coffee? I said, yeah, I'll get you the coffee. So we stopped the car and I said, now Vanessa, the coffee I drink is Folgers Colombian Gold Coffee. It's that dark thing, it's the fun, that's the stuff. She says, okay, Dad, okay. And she goes again, I said, now remember, Vanessa, it's Folgers the Colombian. He says, Dad, I'm not stupid. Don't ask me again. You ask me again, forget it. I'm not gonna get it, okay? You understand? I've already heard your Folgers Colombian dark. That's all I want to hear, I'm going to get it. She runs in, it's okay. Runs in, she grabs the coffee, she comes out in 30 seconds, she has the coffee, she says, I got the coffee, I leave. You know, we drive the car. I drive her home, I go back to the house, and I take the coffee out, and it's the breakfast shit. I don't know if you've ever been to this place. I'm sitting there and I'm saying, you know, I just took the entire family out to dinner. I spent the gross frickin' national product of Peru. I didn't ask for anything. I didn't even ask for a thank you. I asked for one lousy thing. Folgers Colombian Coffee, 100% Colombian coffee. And I specifically said, that's the coffee I want. And what's even worse, she says to me, like, you say it one more time, you know, she does me that stuff. And I said, and I come home and she gets me the flipping poison shit. And now I'm thinking, I said, this is like on purpose. I mean, I'm trying to figure, I said, it's like the, I said, this can't stand this. And I said, it's 10:30 at night, so I'm going to call her up. I said, I got to call. It's not right. It's not right. Now, let me tell you why. Because she cannot be allowed to get away with this shit. And I'm going to call. Now, let me explain something. I'm going to call her up, and I'm not going to go alcoholic on her. I'm not going to be, you know, I'm going to say, Vanessa, I just thought you would know that even though I told you twice to get the right thing, you understand what I'm saying? You got me the breakfast, you got me the wrong. I'm just gonna like explain to her, because it just isn't right that she be allowed to think that she did anything, you know, she's gotten told that deal. And I'm gonna tell you something, every bone in my body said to do that. That was the right thing to do. And then somewhere along the line, this is what happens. This is the shit that happens if you go to too many meetings and church and all that sort of stuff. This thought went across my mind, and it said this. I said, if I call Vanessa and I tell her that she got the wrong coffee, what she's actually going to hear, trust me, because I know Vanessa, she's sensitive, because she's like me. I just told my sponsor I'm sensitive. He said, no, Russ, great artist is sensitive. You're just touching. If I tell her you got the wrong coffee, what she's going to hear is what she's going to hear me say in her mind is, I just want you to know you're a loser. And women don't need men to tell them they're losers. And daughters don't need fathers to tell them they're losers. They need fathers to tell them, to uplift them, and tell them they love them, and that they're great. And so, I didn't make the phone call. And
And I'll tell you why this is important. You see, by the way, what I'm talking, everything I'm talking about is alcoholism. This is all about, this is why I go to meetings. This is why I go to church. This is why I go to Bible study. This is why, this, you know what I'm saying? That's why I'm here tonight. That's why I'm here tonight telling you this story. Because every time I tell this story, I remember this story. I need to hear this story. And I'll tell you why this is important. I sponsor men who have children that they haven't, and grandchildren that they haven't spoken to in 15, 20 years. And you know why they haven't spoken to them? Because they made a phone call because they weren't going to let them get away with it. I have men in my life that are alone and they're in their 50s and 60s and their kids won't talk to them because they felt they had to make a phone call because they weren't going to allow them to get away with it. And they couldn't, they could not not make the phone call. And that's what we suffer from today. I don't suffer from a drinking problem. I suffer from something called alcoholism, which can hurt a lot of people. I can hurt a lot of people. I don't need alcohol to hurt somebody. I've heard most people in my life, I heard Cold Stone sober. So for the grace of God, I didn't make that phone call and I have a great relationship with my kids these days. All my kids. Even the son, who we're going up to see, me and my wife are going up to see in about 3 weeks with two of our grandkids. You know, just one of our grandkids is having a birthday. So we're going to bring them all up there to New York. So I can't tell you how happy I am that I was here. I really am. I mean that. You know, I mean, my sponsor, whenever somebody asks you to do something, I always say yes. I can't tell you how much I respect everybody in here for being involved and doing this stuff and doing AA. And I know you guys are solid. You know, you do it, you know, like the book. You're like big book people. And this is where I want to be. I want to be hanging out with you guys. Somebody asked me in here, well, I think it was last night, a question that I've been asked so many times. In Alcoholics Anonymous, but some people are aware of my schedule, he says, how can you run a law office and have all these things going on and do the stuff you do? And I simply answer, because it's as simple as answer, I guess I don't play golf. I mean, I used to play golf. I don't play golf. I don't go to football games. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't want you to feel guilty if you go to football games or anything like that. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says God will give you everything you need if you stay close to him. Work well. And I believe that God has work for me to perform. And my work, the way it tells me in the book, is to be a maximum service to God and other people. Just like Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa was assigned to the people in India. You know, I'm assigned to the crazies. You know what I mean? Just like me. You understand what I'm saying? This is what I do, and I do it just like Dr. Bob said, because I love, I would rather be here than at the football game. It's not even a sacrifice for me. I love being with alcoholics. I love meeting alcoholics. I love helping alcoholics. Somewhere around 15 years sober, I used to go to meetings all the time. You ever been to a meeting and you say, man, I needed this meeting? You ever say, man, I need a meeting? And I'm not saying I don't need meetings. I'm not saying I haven't been there, but I'll tell you something. For years, I go to more meetings now, not because I, quote, need a meeting, to see if there's anybody there that needs help that I can do something. You know, and I know every one of my sponsors, and if there's guys in here that have, and I know there are, I see David over there that have 30 years plus or 25 years plus, I know that you know what I'm talking about. I know you're going to meetings to try to help the new guy or help anybody that needs help. You know, and I know you're grateful. You're grateful you've been put in a place that you can be in God's will and helping other people. You know, I no longer have those voices that tell me I'm a piece of crap. I don't have enough voices going on. Hey, once in a while, the voice pops up, but that's okay, because you know, when the voice pops up in the shower, you're a piece of crap, all it tells me is I can still go to the closed meetings. You can still go, Rush, you're still crazy, you still got that little deal in you, you still need God's help. You know, I don't ever want to get to the situation where I think like I'm cured, and I got an A, and this thing can't come back anymore. So thank you very much, God bless you.
Thank you, Russell. That was fantastic, extremely relatable. And you know, I was able to relate to that, and I know multiple people in the room were able to relate to that. We're not relating to Russell as a person, we're relating to full-blown alcoholism. And my first car was a Camaro, and I could go on, literally on and on. Like, I was dying up in the front, because that's me to a T, especially the lynch mob. You get me started, and that's who I am to a T. So I, you know what, Russell, thank you. Thank you very much. But to thank you properly, we're going to have Tyler come up here.
My name is Tyler. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tyler.
Oh, man, I'm sure I'm not the only one in here, but I feel like Russell's talking directly to me when I hear him talk. I want to tell a quick funny story about when I met Russell in Banff. I got there, this was about a year ago, I think. I had got there late. I think you talked on Friday, and I missed that. Met Russell, sat down, had dinner with him and Kevin. And I had agreed, I didn't have a hotel up there or anything, but I had agreed to go back to the treatment center and come back the next day. I did that. I missed the second talk. But then after, Russell's like, hey, I talked about you today. And I'm like, me being the self-centered alcoholic that I am, I'm like, I go back to my house and I'm like, I probably listened to that thing 10 times. Thinking like, what did he say? Like, did he say my name? but I kind of just got the joke within the last few weeks that that he was talking about an alcoholic, and he definitely classified me as such. But I already classified myself, so that was good anyways. But yeah, I on behalf of PPG Group, Russell, I want to thank you for coming out here and sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. I know I can speak on behalf of quite a few people in this group. You know, we listen to you. A lot of us are a part of that chain email, and we get emails from you every couple weeks with your new talks all over the U.S. and it's been really helpful, I assure you. And I'm so glad that you made a decision a long time ago to be of maximum service to God and to help other people, because I know you've helped me a lot and a lot of other people as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, before we close out, Kevin, is there anything you could think of? No? Okay. I just want to say thank you for everybody coming out. Like I had said previous, of course, it's a long day. You know, we had some wonderful speakers that spoke for us today. And if you wouldn't mind standing up and closing us out with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Hey, Alan, there's one thing. The biggest request if we can, just start helping to stack the chairs.
There you go. He got you to end it off.
Oh, nice.